Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Welcome back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Nick Osello. Nick, how are you doing, buddy?
Terry, let's cut the crap here. You can't say I have a surprise for you in the opening and expect me to not say, hey, what's the surprise? Hit me.
We have a sponsor.
Whoa, let's go.
Not only do we have a sponsor, we have what, if you had taken odds on this podcast getting a sponsor like 3 years ago, would have absolutely been the longest shot. The NCAA is sponsoring this podcast.
Oh my goodness. Does that mean I have to tighten up anything that I might say about the NCAA in the future, or are they letting the boys rip?
If it were under normal circumstances, I would say, yeah, you can just tighten it up like 10%. But one of the reasons this deal got over the finish line is because we have a fox in the hen house. We have a listener who you and I met on the concourse at Lincoln Financial Field last year. Mm-hmm. And there is no question that was a big factor in what got this deal over the finish line. So I would imagine that as he's listening to this right now, he absolutely does not want us to change. If anything, he definitely wants you to stick with your non sequitur political bits.
Well, that's very good to know. Can't recall that guy's name. Apologies. Was pretty deep and could barely talk at that time. But thank you. And what an exciting time. And just for the listeners that are already calling BS on that, you think that I'm going to allow some NCAA puppeteer to control what I say, what Terry says? No, you're still going to get the great high-quality content. But we have a sponsor. Congratulations, Terry. That's great news.
If in any way you feel constrained, you can just sue them and they'll settle for millions of dollars, because that's basically what everybody else in the United States is doing right now.
Sometimes people go, hey, Nick, what's your retirement plan? And I'm like, I either need to find a lawsuit or like get hit by a city bus. So I'll keep you posted on retirement plans. Maybe that's just a once a time year bit, but kind of cancels out. I'm pumped the NCAA is sponsoring us, and now I'm not going to be pursuing litigation against them. So now I'm down to just getting hit by a city bus and filing a lawsuit against a municipality.
All right, let's do this live read. The men's and women's NCAA championship weekend is heading back to Gillette Stadium, held jointly for the first time since 2017. From May 23rd to May 26th, there is nowhere else in the lacrosse world to be other than Foxborough, Massachusetts, for 8 of the best and most impactful games of the season. The action starts on Friday with the women's D1 semifinals, continues on Saturday with the men's D1 semis, and then championship action starts Sunday with men's D2, men's D3, and women's D1, culminating Monday afternoon in the men's D1 final. Nick, again, not a part of the deal-making structure, but I'm told that you were inquiring about some hoity-toity accommodations for this year's championship weekend. How's that pursuit going?
Even though I have moved on to a different career, I still have an active role in Second Slide, and Second Slide has gotten in some interesting rings. And we were kind of having partnerships talking about, hey, what would be a really cool event for Second Slide to do? We had a presence at the Final Four last year, and this gentleman in Second Slide were kind of just in talks and exploring about doing something cooler, more to follow as those inquiries are being followed up on. And boy, would it be nice to go from living in your car to hoity-toity stuff. So the evolution of startup is a wild swing nonetheless.
This year, Inside Lacrosse is proud to partner with the NCAA to offer you, our loyal listeners, $5 off all single-day ticket options for men and women by using the code ILPOD at checkout. So head to ncaa.com/laxtickets, that's LAXTICKETS, and enter ILPOD at checkout to purchase your tickets. You know you're going to be at championship weekend, so why not get $5 off and help us show the NCAA how awesome our loyal listeners are by purchasing your tickets today. Once again, that's ncaa.com/laxtickets and ILPOD at checkout for $5 off your tickets. You are going to hear that read about 75 more times between now and May, so please get used to it.
Yeah, and I'll start pitching, hey, if we're working with the NCAA, it might not be good to do Oklahoma drills in the parking lot as part of the sponsorship thing because of the CTE stuff, but hey, maybe I try and find some bonus free ways to grease the NCAA so that they're proud of sponsoring this podcast. And speaking of the NCAA, Terry, what a game. What a weekend of games.
Unbelievable.
Better than week zero.
It certainly was. We have a lot to get to. We are recording this on Super Bowl Sunday before the Penn State, Villanova, and Hampton, Iona games. So make sure to check out InsideLacrosse.com. Matt Kinnear and Dan Abern are going to be on site in Philadelphia for that epic Keystone State clash, which we once recorded this podcast when I was driving home, I remember, from covering that game. I think that was 2 years ago. I would like to be the first to congratulate either Hampton or Iona for their first Division I win in program history. So either Coach Chaz Woodson or Chad Sermon, congratulations.
Yes, that's going to be awesome. But I, unbiased, I think, actually, two quick bits. One, the Keystone State should be Colorado because that's where the worst beer on earth is brewed at the Coors Brewery, Keystone Ice. I grew up on it in high school. Shout out Keystone for making $12 enough to get 36 high schoolers drunk. And then second, talk about sponsorships. I'm going to Gillette Stadium. Are you kidding me? My head's going to be shining and whistling. So Delaware, Utah was the marquee game of the weekend. And Terry, one thing that Coach Corrigan always preached to me was egoless clarity. So what I'm just going to do is kind of tee you up because there was some technical aspects of what made this game so great and weird and unique that I would fumble. So I'm just going to say Delaware won 13-12 on an absolute incredible fourth quarter. I'll just tee it up. Utah Ryan Stones had 2 and 5 for 7. Cade Faulkner and Jonas Hunter had hat tricks. Delaware, there's a player that you're going to want to mention. Chicken Parmesan, Bennett Palmer. He had 4 goals on the day. Corey Capri had 1 and 4 for 5. Brendan Powers had 2 and 3 for 5. But why did I give Mr. Palmer, Bennett Palmer, a big shout out there, Terry. Can you explain what set up his heroic goal?
Yeah, of course. So, all right, just to set the stage a little bit, obviously we had Cody Hart on this podcast last week because Utah's win over Ohio State in Columbus was the best upset of the week. And so that was certainly a precursor to what was one of the two most intriguing games, I think, certainly in my opinion and probably in the broader opinion heading into this. Delaware making their season debut, going to Salt Lake City, challenged Carolina versus Michigan for the two most interesting games, and we're going to get to that Wolverines Tar Heels game here in a minute. But I just want to take a second to reflect on how insane it is that Delaware going to Utah was legitimately the highlight game of the season. And then the other thing that made it great was that, as you know, this early season kind of thing works itself out, so many of these games are played at noon and 1 o'clock. And so as a result, you really have to, you know, have a broad periphery in order to be able to consume as much as this as possible. Well, this was a game that, you know, was staggered because it was being played in the Mountain Time Zone. And so as a result, it ended a little bit later and was kind of the spotlight game that everybody was paying attention to. And boy, what an ending. As you mentioned, absolutely insane. So first, Delaware scores to go up 1 with 2 minutes and 2 seconds to play. So, Utah calls a stick check on faceoff specialist Logan Premtage, and it's deemed an illegal stick. He is assessed a 3-minute non-releasable penalty. The Utes get the ball off of the faceoff, meaning like there is no faceoff, so they just, you know, the penalty starts, and they score 14 seconds later. Off of that goal to tie it at 12, Delaware wins the man down faceoff. Again, this is a non-releasable penalty, so it was a man down faceoff. Delaware calls a timeout in order to kind of structure their man down kind of penalty kill situation. Play restarts. They have a midi kind of getting doubled and runs into trouble. They manage to burn, I think, probably about 25 seconds off the clock and call a second timeout. This is an important detail because the commentators were very confused, as were a lot of folks on social media, as to why Delaware had 2 timeouts, because coming out of halftime, they were late, and so they used a timeout then. And the thought would be that that was assessed to the second half, and as a result, they only had 1 timeout left. No, no, no. This was a detail in the rule book that I learned 2 years ago this day, which I guess means that I probably wasn't covering Penn State Villanova that day, but whatever, it doesn't matter. John Tillman, who now I believe is certainly on the Rules Committee, might be the chair of the Rules Committee, of course, knew this detail, which was if you have a timeout left at the end of the first half, you can use it before the end of halftime, and it goes towards your first half total, which leaves you with two timeouts in the second half. That rule has become even more important in an era of replay review and the association with timeouts. So a little-known rule that not a lot of people were familiar with, but allowed Delaware to call a second timeout, maintain possession. Coming out of that timeout, Bennett, Chicken, Palmer, Jean just went absolute beast mode and like split multiple doubles, gets to the middle of the field. Colin Lenskold, Utah's very good goalie, was in the goal. It wasn't as if they were trying to double to get the ball back. This was a tie game. They wanted to get the ball back because they were man up and they had just scored 14 seconds into having the ball in a man up situation. And so they were certainly, you know, hopeful that this was going to, they were getting the ball back in regulation and not have it go to overtime, where if Delaware had possession at the end of regulation, then they wouldn't have been, there would not have been a faceoff to start overtime. So the Palmer puts the Hens up one, 13-12, with about, I want to say, like 40-ish, 45, 50 seconds left. Coming off of that, Delaware again wins the faceoff, but Nico DiPonio, one of Utah's best defensemen, probably his best defenseman, their best defenseman, certainly when it comes to causing turnovers, does what he does and caused a turnover. The loose ball falls to Ryan Steins, Utah's attackman, who you mentioned was their leading scorer on the day. And in transition, he takes a low-to-low shot. Kevin Ellington, Delaware's goalie, makes his 15th save of the day. They attempt a clear, but fail the clear. Again, Utah has an opportunity to tie with they got the ball back with like 18 seconds left. Cody Hart carrying into transition, or carrying into the offensive zone. Not a ton of urgency. It was clear that he didn't realize how much time was left in the game. Passes to an attackman, and there's a faint attempt at a game-tying goal, and the clock expires. It was insane, and there is a lot to unpack with that. And fortunately, we're joined by a Delaware superfan who's going to help us do it.
Jake, can you hear us? Jake Hervada, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. But there's no camera, which is a bit of a bummer. If you could figure that out, that'd be great, so we can see those shiny pearly whites.
There we go.
For the people listening at home, why don't you give a little background on why you're such a Delaware expert?
Yeah, spent 6 years at the university as a player. Uncommon there. Couldn't get enough. And then also came back and went and spent a year as a coach as well. So, big time Delaware lacrosse super fan, you could say.
And from the rumor mill that was swirling, you're taking credit for Palmer being a member of the Blue Hens. Is that correct?
We can run with that. Was on staff when we recruited him. Probably more of a Coach Rukowski thing, but yeah, we can run with that for sure.
I mean, did you see that he was able to have that stuff in his pocket? Because what I'm going to call from now on, if there's ever a double team split, it's going to be the Jordan Wolfe to Bennett Palmer spectrum. Jordan Wolfe could just run and actually split doubles. Palmer just seems to blow them up and truck stick people. So I don't even want to use the term split the double. He nuclear bombed the double before getting the goal. You had to have seen that coming, right?
I don't know, man. That was pretty legit. He definitely just ran the dude over, which didn't see that on the recruiting trail, but was super fired up about it.
Jake, what was your take on that ending?
It was crazy, man. Awesome game. I think the stick check thing is what it is, right? I kind of compare it to like the slide in the NFL, right? Like coaches are going to do it, going to try to find ways to win no matter what whatever it is. I think the timing of it was kind of weak. Huge fan of Coach McMinn, but crazy ending and, you know, maybe a little bit of a ball don't lie situation there. So
you might be able to clear this up for me, and I apologize if this is a little bit more technical and nuanced, but the fact that it was a 3 minute as opposed to a 1 minute suggests that it was not a function of the pocket. A 1 minute penalty for a stick check is related to the stringing of the pocket. Usually the pocket is too deep. But it is most likely that the plastic was bent and that the ball wasn't coming out, right? Is that what we should assume, not knowing exactly what the call was?
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think if it's the length of the stick or the plastic, it's a 3 minute. Yeah, I think that's correct.
Yeah, so I do think that the controversy or the take machine of is it weak to call a stick check on a faceoff guy is an important topic. I want Nick's thoughts on it, but we'll save that for a second and just kind of take a broader look at this game in general. Obviously, Delaware having the deck stacked against them in two ways, one being not having a game under their belt, playing a team that had actually played a game already. That's a little bit offset by having film on Utah against Ohio State last week, but then also, you know, having to travel two time zones and play at altitude. How do you just react to the resilience that the team showed, particularly given that they withstood some runs from the Utes?
Yeah, it was awesome to see, especially with all the young guys in week one. It's going to be a young team, but yeah, and also probably Delaware doesn't travel a ton, right? So unique for them. And super cool to see the, you know, that come out in week one, especially from some young guys like Palmer and some other young guns that are seeing some time early.
Jake, I mean, holy smokes, you got to give us a little more juice or a little more insight. I feel like I'm talking to a freshman player that just went through SID training. I mean, I thought you'd be logging on to this, popping a bottle of champagne in your britches, not just sitting here looking all pissed in a hoodie and a hat. Where'd you watch the game and who'd you watch it with? Was this even on the radar as like a, hey, let's get some of the hens together and put together a game watch?
Sorry, bag just fell next to me there. I actually watched it.
That's the type of action he's looking for.
Throw some bags
backpack
around.
Backpack off
Why not?
The shelf as we're speaking there. Actually watched it at Wells Fargo Center during the Wings game. Mike Robinson was playing in Philly for Halifax, another Delaware alum. On the practice squad for the Wings, so there was about 25 Delaware alums at Wells Fargo watching, you know, dual action lacrosse yesterday, which was pretty sweet.
And so, what was that like? They must have gone crazy.
Wells Fargo. Was it one phone that everybody was huddled around?
Yeah, pretty much one phone that everyone was huddled around, and then Mike also had a hat trick, so there was a lot of action going on yesterday.
What's your take on the game in total? Like how the way that it unfolded and how they responded to some of those Ute runs that I mentioned?
Yeah, it was good to see. I mean, the Delaware slow start is something that we've kind of coined. You know, Coach DeLuca hates it. He freaks out about the Delaware slow start, but it's almost like a trademark at this point. You go down early, probably losing your tide at halftime, and it's kind of a game of runs. And like I said, it was cool to see a lot of the young guns getting involved there, you know, especially with all things considered. The runs were crazy.
Wow, the runs were crazy. Good stuff. who was acting the craziest? Who's like the biggest psycho fan that was present at Wells Fargo Arena?
I'd say Drew Linkitis. He was locked into both games for sure.
Well, and I feel like if there's a place to get nuts about sports this weekend, Philly's going to be one of it because the city's going to burn down regardless of the result tonight, and I feel like nobody's going to get arrested. Jake, quick one here, kind of related to Delaware, given some factors, but Doge cutting USAID has been in the news, and I feel like they're painting with a wide brush on some of these cuts. Do you think that there should be a more nuanced approach to cutting, particularly the impact on some of the red states that really supported this snowball effect? For example, I was reading about soybean research funding. That's going to have a huge impact in Mississippi. Do you think that we should continue as Doge with aggressive wide brush cutting, or do you think there should be some more nuance?
Yeah, wow, wide brush cutting. Didn't expect this from the Tailgate podcast. I'm going to say whatever is in favor of Delaware lacrosse, recruiting, NIL, them winning, continue on Doge. And then other than that, I'm going to leave that there.
I've got a final one for you, Jake. The ass kicking chickens. Is that the best nickname for any team in college lacrosse?
Yes, 100%.
Perfect. Well done, brother. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, guys. I'll see you.
Absolutely. It was great having you, bud.
I am going to light him up on text so bad. That was the worst interview we've ever had, Terry.
Did we get Westberg and then you did the same thing to him?
Pretty much.
And then what happened? He said like the funniest five things in a row that you've ever seen in text messages?
Yeah. And
all right, well, enjoy.
There's text message funny, which Jake is, and then there's podcast funny, which, you know, seems like Jake just wanted to be right down the middle of the fairway. Good to watch young guys get in. Sick. But he's a great dude.
Couple other notes on this one. Last week we talked about Utah faceoff guy Tyler Colkle's success against Ohio State. This week, Delaware combined to go 17-27. So OJ Morris combining with Logan Premtage, as we talked about. And it wasn't just about the overall percentage. It was also about the combination of timing, right? So game tied, man down, and then also game up one, man down to win two faceoffs. Pretty remarkable. So shout out to those guys and Coach Capinos for having them ready for a tough matchup. Corey Capri, who you mentioned, tied for Delaware's leading scorer. He's a grad transfer from Yale who basically didn't play as a Bulldog. Not only did he have a goal and four assists in his debut, but the Upstream Lacrosse Twitter account compared him to Jules Henningberg, which is pretty remarkable. So just a couple notes and certainly some interesting stuff to keep an eye on for the Blue Hens as the season progresses.
And two things. I would say that going into this weekend, there was high-level just high-level analysis heading into the game. There were, you know, hot, lukewarm, and cold levels of interest. I would have put this game kind of in the cold level of interest. Like, oh, yeah, you know, Utah's probably going to win by a couple goals, but Delaware might have a good showing. So shout-out Delaware for making this the marquee game of the week and certainly a game of the year contender. Just because regardless, there's probably going to be some other photo finishes, but just the uniqueness surrounding it. I mean, that's why we play the game. Second thing, I love when games like this happen because it gives me a reason to put Delaware and Utah on the board for next week's kind of hot interest where it's like, how is Utah going to bounce back? Was this just a fluke by Delaware? I love these early season storylines. I just weeks like 0-4 are so fun to just, okay, who's going to be, you know, kind of the fan favorite for the rest of the season. And Delaware, I mean, they put themselves on the map this week. Congratulations, fellas.
Keep it moving.
I would put this one in the lukewarm interest. We're going to move on to Maryland at Loyola. Now, keep in mind, Loyola lost 13-6 last week. So this was one that I put in the lukewarm because I assumed Maryland was going to win by 5-6 goals. How is Loyola going to bounce back? What kind of grit are they going to show? And this was a defensive battle. And we've talked a good amount on this podcast about quality goaltending. Is it a result of quality defense, or did the goaltenders just make saves? I would put this more firmly on this was just a very well goaltended game. Both offenses were getting relatively good looks consistently enough for me to say that the goaltending was kind of the X factor. And it was legitimately good goaltending, really, until it wasn't. Loyola was up 5-2 with 13 minutes left in the third quarter before the scoring opened up for both teams. Or third quarter, sorry.
Fourth quarter.
Fourth quarter?
Right?
I thought it was 5-2 with 13 in the third.
Well, either way, trust your gut. Keep going.
Trust your gut. Spanos stepped up. He scored three of Maryland's next four as Maryland scored four in a row to make it 6-5. Remy Reynolds, I think, had the play of the game. An unbelievable can opener. Sprints down and shoots it directly at the goalie's stick, and it somehow goes in. And then really what started working for Maryland was the I'm going to start at X and run up the hash and just shoot a low angle shot. Ironically enough, that's how Loyola forced overtime, but it seemed like that was the secret sauce that Maryland found that was able to push them over the top and get, ultimately it was Keegan who scored the OT winner. But that get ahead of steam from X and shoot running up the hash was what Maryland relied on to mount this comeback. And Loyola didn't hear no bell, and they're 0-2, but they are a trap team, and their record does not show the type of team that they can, you know, go pound for pound with.
I think this is a easy game to try to take like broad. I'm stealing from your Doge comment.
Broad strokes.
Broad brush conclusions from. So I saw Maryland in the fall, and one of the things that was the like firmest takeaway was that Eric Spanos, Braden Erickson, Daniel Kelly was a very solid group at attack. And then they've got like 9 to 12 guys who are in contention for their top two midfield lines. And that's a lot. And what was important, and this is definitely informed by the way that last year ended, is, you know, Maryland moved Erksa and Spanos between attack and midfield and just continued to try to figure out the offensive personnel questions. And when you bring in four, we talked about this last week, when you bring in four or five guys who can compete for roles offensively, to have three positions locked down at the attack certainly limits the opportunity that those, you know, that that group can compete for, especially when you've got, you know, a bunch of middies like Zach Whittier on the roster who are kind of known commodities and they're going to take up some minutes as well. So the point I'm getting at is the entire season, really, we're basically just going to continue to wait for the Maryland offense to start tinkering with their personnel. And I did confirm while we were talking, Maryland had two goals 47 minutes into this game. So Spanos' goal that made it 5-3 happened with 13:17, I believe, remaining in the fourth quarter. To only have two goals through 47 minutes strikes me as enough for John Tillman and Mike Phipps to start tinkering with the personnel. Now, your point is well taken. Max Watkinson, I believe, ended with 11 saves. It was going to be an area of concern or consideration or at least interest for Loyola, given Luke Stout, a two-year starter, had graduated and transferred to Hopkins and is now their starter. And there were three or four contenders for that job that Watkinson won out. But I do think that at the other end of the coin, the theme for this season is going to be pretty much everybody is young. And so the rate of improvement, who is the best at getting better as the season goes along, is going to be a big storyline. Coming away from Georgetown, Loyola was really disappointed that they gave up five goals in the third quarter. And Charlie Toomey talked post-game of Maryland about how against Georgetown, they didn't play the full 60 minutes. In this game, he felt like they played this full 60 minute plus. And that was absolutely evidenced by Keenan Everhart, he's listed as a sophomore, but he didn't play last year. So I'm assuming redshirt freshman attackman, who, with 2 seconds left on an end line restart, gets topside on Will Schaller and manages to beat Logan McNaney to tie the game 7-7 in a very dramatic play and set up overtime where Loyola did not get possession. And that's what ultimately, like you said, set up Matthew Keegan's game-winning goal, which Kevin Brown pointed out in his post-game story, a kind of important redemption line storyline for Keegan, because he took an ill-advised shot with less than 2 minutes to go that kind of set up Loyola's opportunity to tie the game. So there's just a lot to keep an eye on from the standpoint of Loyola's ability to get better, because there are so many guys that they are relying on that haven't played a ton, whereas for Maryland, they have a ton of guys that have played a ton, especially at the offensive end, either for the Terps or for Binghamton or Salisbury or wherever, and so at Fairfield. And so the question is, how is the stew going to come together? Those are the two storylines that I take away from this one, because obviously it's disappointing for Loyola to lose, especially when, you know, they led by a considerable margin for the majority, two, three goals for the majority of the game. And then on top of that, their defense had played so well. And so, you know, to give up five in the fourth quarter is really disappointing. In addition to which, on two separate occasions, they managed to fight back and tie the game 6-6 and 7-7. And so, you know, when you take all of that into consideration, it's really disappointing. But I think ultimately, the most important thing for the Greyhounds is as they are 0-2, are they going to get better as the year goes on?
And I will say, I think Maryland's offense was stifled by a lack of urgency for the first half majority of the game. and I'll draw parallels to this game, Jacksonville versus Duke, even though they were wildly different. But it just seemed like Maryland knew that if they needed to score, they'd be able to get a quality shot with a good amount of consistency. So if you're a Terps fan, I don't think it's time to be hitting any panic buttons with an OT win over what should have probably been a 3-4 goal win. And what was interesting to me was Maryland, when they had success, seemingly was attacking the same side of the field. The best goal that they scored was a dodge down the left alley, feed it to the guy on the left alley behind GLE, only to pass it up that same alley for a step down. And it was just curious to me because in years past, Maryland has done such a good job of attacking one side of the field and then exploiting the weakness on the backside. So for them to find at least a glimmer of hope in, oh, if you can dominate one half of the field as you figure out your personnel, that's just going to be something that I keep an eye on. That I was like, okay, if I'm a Maryland fan, there were some silver linings and it wasn't just, we went out and performed poorly for three quarters.
One other thing that might not be a silver lining, but a mitigating factor is the home crowd. And Tills talked about how Loyola for home openers always shows up. And there were 2,400 fans. And when Charlie Toomey was asked postgame about what he attributed the fervor to, he said, honestly, college students, they now allow tailgating. Kids want to wake up and they want to have fun. And that's it's that type of environment that we feel behind us. So the students are always like right behind Loyola's bench and giving them a ton of energy. And I believe it was Eric Spanos that commented postgame that they knew that they were going to have to manage that, which is wild for a variety of reasons. But one of the things that I take away from it is, Loyola has always had great crowds. That's not a surprise. But what is it? I mean, just kind of what it says about the sport and specifically what it says about February when, you know, 2,500 fans can be so boisterous, coming off of a home opening win in a 50,000, 60,000 seat stadium against Richmond, where, you know, that kind of is adversity is kind of, I don't want to call it head scratching, but at the same time, it's both fun and exciting, but also it just kind of speaks to how we need more venues that make it tough on opposing offenses such that they're used to it.
Well, and I will say there's a stark difference in the reason places are difficult to play against.
We already talked about one in Utah.
Yeah. Well, and the biggest contrast in my experience was the difference between DU and Drexel. DU has kind of that hostile, angry crowd where their energy is going to impact the game. You're running out to boos. That can motivate you, but also when DU scores and their crowd goes nuts, it just makes the low moments a little bit more defeating. Versus Drexel, which has, I think they had 7 fans, and you could hear everything that they were saying.
And they were mean because they're from Philadelphia.
Oh my God. Like we were trying to build up a lead so that we could draw up a play where somebody would take a low to high shot and try and hit like the 7 dude little cluster. West Philly's finest ain't that fine. No offense to the great city of Philadelphia, but you guys produce some incredible scumbags where they're looking up like the names of your parents, your sisters, like telling you what they did to them. So on the spectrum of difficult places to play against, you want a nice crowd where you can't hear what individuals say. And I wonder if Loyola's crowd, I wonder what spectrum they fell on.
One more thing I want to mention about this game, and it's going to be a little bit of a theme as we go throughout the rest of this podcast and certainly a trend to watch as the season develops. But, you know, Loyola found success defensively in front of Watkinson, not just by utilizing zone defense, but specifically by shifting in and out of zone defense. And when Maryland talked about what kind of the switch that flipped in the fourth quarter that allowed them to find more offensive success, they pointed to the hardness of their dodging, right? You always hear from coaches, you have to dodge hard. You cannot go, you know, half-hearted. And what's interesting to me about that is, and this definitely is a carryover from basketball more so than I think it is something that's a truism in lacrosse, but the notion that you beat a zone defense with ball movement – And we're going to talk about Carolina, Michigan next, and I'll kind of save this point, but it is both interesting to – it will be interesting to watch how teams utilize zone, not just in terms of the type of zone and how frequently they use it and when in the game they use it, but also about how they use it as a transition or a counterpunch to playing man, specifically if – you know, there are circumstances within possessions, right? So if we have an end line restart with under 20 seconds left on the shot clock, then we're going to switch to zone and we're not going to guard at X. Or if it's going to be a way to protect against personnel that gets caught back on defense, or if it's going to be a way to, you know, mitigate against sub-game losses, right? So we're gonna go into a four-man zone while we're subbing our defensive personnel on in order to, you know, be more reactive to dangerous dodges from up top. Keep an eye on that and be particularly attuned to what just the principles of a zone, right? Which means like passing off the same player as he moves through space, because it can be tricky, especially with teams that are aggressive in their slide and recover, you know, a hedge from the adjacent or effectively a fake slide can look like a zone in ways that can be difficult to suss out from time to time. But there was definitely a lot of zone defense played on Saturday.
Yeah, I always thought that the biggest problem with zone is that the offense knows that it's coming. So if you ever find a way, not on an end line restart where you're throwing an entirely different look and giving the offense time, I'm like, if you can figure out a way to do that mid-possession, it's a great tool. If not, to your point, it always starts with a good attacking one of the gaps of the zone, and it just crumbles from there. I hate zone. I'm already arguing about it with Logan Ball, the head coach of Bishop Kelly, which I'm the defensive coordinator for. We're going to compromise and do what he wants to do and throw in some BS zone. But as you mentioned, we're moving on. UNC Michigan. I had this as one of the highest levels of interest.
Hot, for me. Hot interest.
Hot soup. After beating Marquette 14-1, I have no other way to say it other than UNC decided to remind Michigan that they aren't in the ACC. We're back to ACC supremacy. You're going to hear it. And it's different than the SEC in football because they're losers in the ACC and the lacrosse world is awesome. I'm going to just provide some more high-level analysis and then let you dig into the weeds and see where it goes from there. Jam Ficarro, the transfer from Princeton, I think he's going to have the biggest impact of any transfer. I'll let you decide if that's true or false. And UNC, this is the game that they needed to show that they had in their wheelhouse with no holes. Relatively close first quarter. I think it was 5-3 at the end of the first quarter. But second quarter and second half, they were the most complete team of the weekend. They had eight goal scorers. Duffy and Petromala with four apiece. But even when they had four apiece, it just kind of seemed like the offense was playing and in mid-season form. They knew what looks that they were going to try and not necessarily forced. They were taking what the defense was giving them. The defense was doing a good job plugging anything that Michigan was trying to do. They were good at the faceoffs. They were good in transition. They were good riding and clearing. So UNC might not be the redheaded stepchild of the ACC anymore. Overreaction, underreaction. What does it say about UNC? What does it say about Michigan?
So my take on UNC has been that they were basically a year behind Syracuse, and there's a relatively, for lack of a better way of putting it, obvious reason to feel that way, it being Dave Petromala having been an assistant coach at Syracuse and then coming over and being assistant coach at North Carolina. And I thought that they were always going to be better this year than they were last year because of the built-in growth. And, you know, last year they were relying effectively on a couple of freshmen in Owen Duffy and Dom Petromala, and then, you know, the team had injury issues and everything that went along with it. And so they missed the NCAA tournament. And heading into last season, my comment about Syracuse was, you know, they should be good enough to host a first-round NCAA tournament game, which means that they'll be favored to win it, and then they should win it, and then that'll take them to quarterfinals. And the gap between a good season, basically my point was the quarterfinals are the expectation this year. And if they exceed that and get to the Final Four, that's a good to great season. And they ended up losing the quarterfinals. And I think the manner in the matchup meant that it was disappointing. But ultimately, for me, when you look at it in terms of preseason expectations, it was right where they belonged. And I think that's where Carolina belongs now, which suggests that they are roughly a top 8 team. Certainly their ranking does not support that, their preseason ranking, but I think that's a function of they haven't shown it, right? And this was their first opportunity to show it. Now, a 14-1 win over Marquette was important for Michigan in terms of, you know, setting the foundation and, you know, figuring out who they were after they graduated, a really important class from a leadership standpoint that had taken them to new heights as a program and back-to-back NCAA tournament appearances. But at the same time, this group has to manage success, and they have to kind of learn a little bit more about what their flaws and deficiencies are, and Carolina was going to be a good team to show them how to do it. To your point about Mike Gianforcaro, Joe Brescia said post-game he thinks he's the best goalie he's ever been around, which, just file that away, that's, you know, an interesting statement. For me, you can take this from both angles. The Tar Heels put up 15, or they held Michigan to 6. I prefer to start with Carolina's offense. And I thought that there were a variety of factors that led to putting up 15 when, you know, Hunter Taylor made 10 saves against Marquette and only allowed one goal. First, I thought that Carolina was really effective in their spacing, especially, again, Michigan ran a fair amount of zone. And I thought that they did a nice job in effectively creating a five man on one side, like overloading one side with five guys on it and letting specifically Owen Duffy for the first goal go to work. But you saw a number of unassisted goals, including Petromalo run through three defenders in order to get a finish. So that was just something that I took note of. The other thing, I think there were probably, that I saw four goals that Carolina scored when the shooter's feet, and it was all Duffy and Petromalo, were below about 2, maybe 2.5 yards above GLE. The low angle shooting that those guys put on was absolutely tremendous. And so those were my takeaways for Carolina offensively. Defensively, they were playing without Peter Tomlin, who is a sophomore. We're told he tore his ACL in a scrimmage against Delaware. Again, going back to that Utah-Delaware game for a second, Carolina apparently took it to the Blue Hens a week ago in a scrimmage. I think they won 15-5. So that was another reason to effectively be impressed by the fact that they were able to turn around, come back, beat a team that had beaten Ohio State relatively handily a week prior. So again, just file that away. I thought that, so playing without their number one defenseman, I thought, and you know, kind of everybody moving up, one of the things that people were curious about was whether Paul Barton, who had been playing LSM, was going to move back down to close defense. He didn't. I mean, he played a little bit of close, but by and large, he was still playing up top. And then Andrew O'Berry was the grad transfer D-Mitty from Harvard, who was absolutely excellent in this game. But down low, Carolina was able to hold their own with a bunch of new faces and guys in new roles, and I thought that was really impressive. I also thought that for Michigan, you know, it showed a lot of trouble initiating. One of the things, Michigan has always been a very pick-oriented offense, even more so now under Scott Beda, and they're very unique in the way that they go about picking. I believe Jerry Byrne talked about this on this podcast last year after that game, where he talked about what they do is not illegal, but it is difficult to prepare for, because effectively they set, then they take a step, and they reset. And so if you're the defender guarding the ball and you have some orientation as to where the pick is coming from, more likely than with any other team, that your initial orientation is going to change and be different. And on the first handful of possessions, Michigan's offensive possessions, what I noticed was how physical the confrontation between the picker and the on-ball defender was, and how many guys got blown up. And it was interesting because it's hard to know whether or not that's Carolina's defensive game plan. We want to blow up these picks and make them not want to set them as the game goes on, or if Michigan wants to just set picks where they take so much physical contact from the on-ball defender that, you know, both the parties are going to fall down and then the pick is absolutely going to work. But there is a subtext to that, which is if you are going to be that reliant on ball picks, you probably don't have a ton of confidence in your ball carriers winning dodges one-on-one. And I think that's probably the right conclusion, especially because Ryan Cohen is their primary dodger, or at least their best primary initiator right now. And I think over the course of his career, what he has shown is he's at his best when he's in a binary decision, specifically when he's running out of the box, and especially when he's being guarded by a short stick as a midfielder. Is he just going to go to the goal and score, or is he going to go and then throw ahead? When you put him into a situation where he has to decide between three or four outcomes, then I think you start to see a little bit of a decay in the impact that he has on the game. And so for me, that's what I'm going to see out of Michigan's offense. I thought they did a nice job, especially early when they kept the game close, of utilizing those picks in terms of creating open looks. Aiden Mulholland's goal is, for me, a really good example of that, the one where he caught and finished on the doorstep as a cutter. If you look about 3 to 5 seconds prior to that, the ball moved very effectively because of the space that was created by a really well-executed on-ball pick. But generally speaking, I thought that Carolina did a really nice job of handling those matchups and making life difficult for Michigan offensively.
Well, and I'll speak for a lot of the teammates that I've had over the years, and I'd say about 75% of defensive-minded players out there, when you're preparing for a team that utilizes the picks as their primary way to get open and make plays, that is the biggest green light on defense and red flag on offense. And I even remember when we would be running set pick plays, I'm like, "What? Why? So that we can bring more guys over to the ball? Like, what are we doing? They should be more off ball or very specific set of picks so that somebody can make a pass to exploit a one-on-one." So absolutely love, and I hate to give UNC props, but like, if it was the game plan where it's like, hey, they're pick heavy, let's just make them not want to set picks and absolutely steamroll every single time. I can't think of a better, a better way to that's just football mindset right there. And then combine that with what I would say is the defense's perspective. It's easier to get better as the game goes on playing against picks than it is for the offense to get more separation as each additional pick is set up. And the only people that you play against that truly utilize those situations are from the north. And if you're playing a team of a bunch of Canadians, you're going to see pick plays that you've never seen before that you don't know how to defend. So agree with the analysis. And if you're kind of saying, oh, is this red flag for Michigan, green flag for UNC? Big red flags for Michigan if they don't have a guy that they can just give to and create space.
If you are listening to this and you're wondering why Nick didn't make it as an NLL player, it's because he hates zone defense and two-man games.
Well, what's funny is I actually started to like two-man games towards the end, but going in, and we talked about this with Coach Byrne, he's like, you do not focus on the pick, you just play your man as best you can. Which, if you know anything about box lacrosse, you just end up getting de-cleated. It was essentially a crackback block on a punt return from 2008 NFL every time I was playing on ball. So I hated it for about a year, and then I was like, oh, this is actually fun, and by that time I had already been labeled as a big, stupid, fat, bald, dumb American. But good for the Americans that can have success. I'm not jealous.
I do want to shout out, I wasn't ready for this, but Chase Colucci, Cole Ashim, and Kai Prochazka were the three starters down low for the Tar Heels. I mentioned Paul Barton up top, but then also one of my favorite players of the last, at this point, going on decade, is Brett Koopman. He played, I think, as a freshman on a junior or senior club team called Nation United. He's a Southern California kid who I hope I'm not wrong about this, but he suffered a serious, serious injury the first football game of his junior year. So like either right before or right after September 1st, when he was going through the commitment cycle, I'm pretty sure he tore his Achilles and then had a little bit of an issue in his recovery and developed drop foot. And so the road back that he has had, he played in 9 games as a freshman last year. But if you saw a highlight of a transition goal, that ended with Duffy finishing on the doorstep. That was started by a really nice play in the middle of the field by Koopman, and it's just really exciting to see him contribute at this level for the Tar Heels, given, again, all the adversity he's battled through. So just wanted to shout those guys out.
Classic good guy, Terry.
There you go.
Well, moving on, Hopkins, Georgetown. I put this as kind of a lukewarm. This is going to be
interesting. Man, you've got like Hopkins really high standards for interest.
There's only like one or two games that I put it hot. Like the hot is for like the top two games of the week.
Okay.
Right. Is that okay on my?
No, it is. It's just
on me. You know. Yeah. Well, and this might be, this was boring game bias. Hopkins won 11-6, and the first goal of the game was from midfield as Georgetown hopped right into the 10-man ride. Collison scored from about 45 yards on, there was a camera angle that showed the perfect path to it. You can judge how good a shot is from midfield by, you know, how much gravity affects it. I think it went down about 3 or 4 feet from the second it went left his stick to the net. Absolute piss missile, and I just love goals like that. So Georgetown was throwing a little 10-man, little appetizer, sampler platter throughout the game, sometimes in it, sometimes not, sometimes pressuring, sometimes not. To me, this game was, for the most part, a 6-on-6 stalemate. Both offenses kind of struggled to get consistent quality open looks. And where Hopkins separated themselves was off faceoff and in transition, and kind of off some of those substitution plays. I think they had 3 or 4, if I recall, including that empty netter to start the game, that whether it was sprinting to midfield and then taking advantage of a trailing defender, whether it was kind of some loose ball scrums, whatever it might have been, it just seemed like Hopkins was the more opportunistic team. And when it's a 6-on-6 stalemate, sometimes you just have to rely on individual performances. Collison is an X factor that will consistently win games. In particular, there was a goal where Georgetown was playing legitimately good defense. They were underneath his elbow, executing a lift check. And he just said, you know what? I'm bigger and stronger than everybody. And whipped what looked like a mid-90s shot into the perfect low corner. So I think there wasn't a whole lot to take away from me for this game because Hopkins just had the better players who made plays more consistently than Georgetown throughout the game. Am I wrong in thinking that?
No, my reaction was that this was Hopkins' third top 20 win in 8 days, including a trip to Denver in a midweek game against a local rival that featured an absolutely spectacular live stream. So there was... It's more of a big picture win than it was a small picture win. The fact that they got through this part of their schedule undefeated and have such a head start relative to the rest of college lacrosse is the thing to take away from this. If I'm going to get granular, I care more about Hopkins' defense holding Georgetown to 6 than the Blue Jays getting to 11 offensively, especially when you consider what you said, right? Which was, you know, they scored a half field goal against the 10-man, and we're going to talk a lot more about that in a second. But also when you consider that Luke Stout made just 6 saves, so goalie was at 50%, and Hopkins won 10 of 21 faceoffs, so they were below 50%. You can, I guess, effectively blame bad shooting for Georgetown, especially in the middle of the game, because they started 2 for 5 and they finished 2 for 2, which meant that they shot, I believe, 2 of 27 in between those. Or to your point, you can give a lot of credit to Matt Collison, who I think, you know, I made a big deal out of Hopkins' fortunes being tied to his development, especially like an emergence as a first team All-American candidate. And I think he's played like that, not just because of some of the shooting that you talked about, but also his playmaking and the variety. Basically, it seems like he's got the tools in his bag to react to how opposing defenses are trying to play him. But then the other one is Hunter Chavette, who we saw get out to a hot start last spring, and then his contributions cooled as the season went along. number one, now that he's in a permanent role, is he going to be able to sustain what he's done so far? I would be surprised if the answer was no. But then also, you saw him do a little bit more than just catch and hammer time and room shots against the Hoyas in terms of, you know, he scored once where he carried the ball through the middle of the field. He did a little bit more from a passing standpoint. He just showed a little bit more with his feet than he had. So I think that that's, you know, the general kind of takeaway from this game for me. And then spinning it forward, I will be interested in how Hopkins generates a presence at X. We talked about the fact that Jimmy Ayers and Dylan Bauer are not the guy they decided to go to, and Eric Chick was. They're really not doing much. They're not orienting their offense very much from behind the goal. And I think that in order to be as variable and numerous as they want to be, they're going to have to add that to the game, add that to their game, and that's going to be something I'm going to keep an eye on.
And I will say, I am a little mad at Chauvet right now. I saw him shoot low to low this game, and he scored. But it's, you know, when the devil goes down to Georgia and challenges Johnny to a fiddle contest, Johnny doesn't say, hey, actually, let's play the drums instead. He does what God put him on his planet to do, which is shoot low to high and play the fiddle. Hey, Chauvet, be Johnny and challenge the devil to a fiddle match. Shoot low to high every single time you have the ball, please.
That's my analogy would be when you can swing like Ken Griffey, you don't bunt.
Is I like that a good mine analogy? Better.
Yeah, yours is yeah. Probably better.
Yours is more concise. I was just kind of riffing right there. Moving on, you mentioned empty net goals and goals in transition. I didn't get a chance to watch this game. You did. My favorite part of this game was your tweet after the game talking about how there was a season's worth of statistics cram-packed into one action-packed game. Virginia takes down Colgate 19-9. You watch this game, and I'm just going to defer to you. Can you let the people know about this track meet, about this absolute gong show and beauty of a game?
Yeah. So basically, I think it was Virginia playing the way Virginia wants to play and Colgate being totally willing to not just allow Virginia to play the way that they want to play, but also, you know, play right there with them. These two teams combined to take 115 shots. They picked up 88 ground balls. They attempted 58 clears. They committed 45 turnovers and 11 penalties. Lars, post-game, the first comment was a very Lars-esque quote about how he was so proud of his men for the way that they played within the spirit of the game, and then said, we picked up 56 ground balls, right? And it's just so, so perfect. I think that there's more to dive into in terms of who Virginia actually is. Coming away from watching them scrimmage Navy, my comment was, and this wasn't a novel comment, people were talking about this before the season, whatever, but they were probably going to have to play fast, whether that was in the clearing game or trying to score off faceoffs, and they were going to be really good in that early part of the offensive set, and they showed that against Navy. Against Colgate, it was even more than that, because Colgate was so committed to the 10-man, and the conversations, and you talked about this a lot, Nick, when you talked about how you can overcome a deficiency at the faceoff X, but especially because what you guys did in a lot of instances was go to the 10-man and try to make it difficult to allow the opponent to clear, because a fail to clear is just as good as a faceoff win, a successful ride is just as good as a faceoff win, I guess. But that the important aspect of it was ball pressure. And if you allow the clearing team to settle with the ball, they're going to figure out a way to advance the ball down the field. And I'm not going to fall into the trap of complaining about fake shots. That's not what Virginia did. Virginia was very content to throw 60-yard, like diagonal passes to Truett Sunderland, who then either got to the cage himself or found somebody open on the doorstep. On their second goal of the game, I don't know who the defenseman was that threw it. If I were going to guess, all of these were Ben Ware, but that's not the case. I think only one or two of them was. But He threw to a relatively open Sunderland. Again, 65-yard bomb. The tweet actually has a football in it from the Virginia men's lacrosse account. The third goal of the game, Sunderland went up and caught a contested 60-yard pass and then found Colsey cutting to the crease, which was insane. For their seventh goal of the game, Ware just pulled up from the top of his own restraining box and hammered a 60-yard shot for a goal. And then for the first goal of the second half, which I believe made it 13-5, came off of the faceoff. I believe, again, it was to Sunderland, who finished with 6 goals and 3 assists, far and away the best game of his career. He caught it. The other ones he caught, like, in like the top right corner of the box, this one he caught, I believe, below GLE. The defender came to play him, and the caption on the tweet was, "Skrrt!" because the defender lost his footing, and Sunderland just went right by him and hammered in, or, you know, just finished it on the empty net because the goalie was covering probably McCabe Millen or Kyle Colsey in the bottom left corner. So, you know, they scored 19 goals. They may have scored more in transition, and well, they definitely did because they scored twice off the faceoff and whatever. They might have had other goals that were like as long distance as those, and I just didn't keep track of them. But it was a remarkable showing against something that, you know, has been it was a huge factor in Colgate's success last year. And I don't want to make it seem like it wasn't in some ways successful in this game because they forced 6 failed clears from Virginia, and Virginia cleared just 80%, which is way below their usual standard. But in the meantime, Ware scored twice, had an assist, caused 2 turnovers, and picked up 9 ground balls. And McCabe Millen also scored twice and added 3 assists. So just a lot packed into one game, man. It was wild.
So we had game of the year contender with Delaware, Utah. If we were doing superlatives and maybe we just throw, what was the most fun game of the year? I mean, would this be early season contender? Do you see a game being more just fun than this? Because that to me seems like the perfect script. A team that is committed to the bit of running the 10-man regardless. Piss missiles being thrown all across the field. That just has to be good old-fashioned fun. That's some backyard schoolyard BS if I were Paul Crewe. You know, in the Mean Machine and in the Longest Yard. How much fun did you have watching this one?
Yeah, it was awesome. I mean, so one of the things, and this was kind of true for Carolina, Michigan as well, is that, you know, these games were played in rain on grass. And so they weren't pretty from a footing standpoint. And that was one of the things that I kind of took away from the games overall in terms of what are you going to spin forward? How much value are you going to put in each of these individual situations? The other thing was Virginia wore orange sleeveless jerseys. Oh. And then most of the players wore orange long sleeve undershirts over the sleeves were over the top of their arm pads. Were the oranges exactly the same? I would like to have been able to judge that in person, but needless to say, it was a look and it elicited strong reactions when I asked my following what they thought of it. Nick, are you like a lacrosse fashion police guy? Do you care about this uniform stuff? And if so, what's your take on Virginia's look?
Inside of you, there are two wolves. The two wolves for me are like, one, objectively terrible uniforms. But the second wolf is anything that gets people pissed off in the aggregate, I'm a fan of, generally speaking. So watching everybody come out of the woodworks, people who would have never sniffed being a bottom of the barrel roster player at Virginia that would have only dreamed to be on the roster going, I hate these uniforms, get them out. I hate them. And I'm like, I like the fact that people are upset about it more than I hate the actual visual appalling uniforms that they were wearing. So I think they suck, but I really enjoy people getting worked up about it.
Fair answer.
What about you? Seems like you were a big fan of it.
Okay, so I'll break. I know that sleeveless jerseys elicit a strong response. They're not my favorite, but I they're not my least favorite. My least favorite are, and I can't believe that you avoided this because it would have just been so funny, but the really super tight Adidas uniforms when they tried to make that happen with like Bryant and Bucknell. Delaware might have had to do it once. But Notre Dame was an Adidas school while you were there, right?
For 3 years, and then senior year, we switched to Under Armour.
You switched to Under Armour?
We literally had an Under Armour party. We were so excited about it.
Yeah. So that's my least favorite look. You remember what I'm talking about, right? They were like really tight.
Exactly what you're talking about. Not flattering. Again, like in football, if you wear tight uniforms, half, you know, 90% of the roster is going to look sick. Lacrosse, you know, you get a face-off guy, you might have a little bit of a barrel, a couple of the goalies. Not a great look.
Yeah. So I'm not going to die on the sleeveless jersey hill. I think that they have looked cool a time or two. I think they look way better when they're contrasting colors with your undershirt. I also think you have to wear an undershirt. You cannot get away with just wearing arm pads and no sleeves, regardless of whether they're long or short. I do like long sleeve shirts over arm pads. I think that's like kind of cool or whatever. I should say I don't dislike it. But yeah, my issue with this Virginia one was just I don't think that the oranges were exactly matching, and it kind of drove me crazy. So it's a no for me, Bob.
No for me. Last point on this is that there's the middle ground is the worst. Like if I was forced to wear a sleeveless uni in college, I would have also worn black ankle socks and
there you go.
No undershirt and just been fully like, committed to the bit. If we're doing this, I'm going to just be, and I might even try and go get a cowboy collar as well. Like, I'm just going to look like a complete idiot out there, or I'm going to try and look sick. The middle ground is where I think you get in the most trouble. And the only thing that I will always take a stand against is like the clout police chasing, where it's like, oh yeah, dude, you lost a midseason game. Get off the field and stop watching them celebrate. You're not Stefon Diggs after losing the either AFC Championship or Super Bowl. That type of stuff drives me nuts. So moving on, the last game we'll talk about, Duke-Jacksonville. Interesting matchup. You know, Jacksonville, not a good first showing, but they, as we talked about in the Week Zero episode, they've shown to be a giant contender, maybe not a giant killer, but always willing to kind of scare one of the blue bloods throughout the season. The final score was 14-9. And I actually was able to watch most of this game, and it just seemed like it was inevitable that Duke pulled away. A lot of Jacksonville's goals, and I don't want to discount the quality of player that Jackson has, but the quality Jacksonville has, but the quality of goals that they had, they just kind of seemed more like janky special plays that didn't have the ability to be able to keep up with the consistency that Duke was showing, to be able to run by their opponent, to be able to feed inside on a quick, on a quick stick to the backside. So while this game was close, I believe game was at 5-5. Duke got a 2-goal advantage to make it 7-5. And I think that was the last time that it was close. It just seemed like Jacksonville could never manufacture what Duke could consistently. Two big notes from this game. Ethan Lamond on Jacksonville had one of the best not SportsCenter top 10 goals of all time. And I say not SportsCenter top 10 because it was a lefty pretend go down the alley, roll back, low to high, near side pipe. Like just an absolute thing of beauty. Every time it happens, it's beautiful. For whatever reason, I think low to highs from lefties are cooler than righties. I think it's camera angle. But we can talk about that later. And Terry, I'm calling my shot right here. Duke is not going to win the national championship this year. As I watched this game, my favorite player in college lacrosse until Notre Dame plays is Aiden McGuire, a short stick D middy for Duke. Absolute freak athlete. When he clears it and gets a full head of steam, it's looking like he's running a 4.3, 4.40. But in particular, there was a play, and while I kind of am going to say this jokingly, I do think it's something that tells us a lot about where this Duke roster is at. He had one of those kind of lift checks where you get under the armpit. The offensive player for Jacksonville had a full head of steam. Aiden was not only able to match his athleticism, but get underneath and with 20 seconds left in the first half, cause an absolutely beautiful turnover. One of the best short stick D-Mitty plays, you know, in the first 2 weeks. And the bench was silent. Nobody was excited. Nobody was jacked up about it. I actually had to go back and rewatch it because, like, I was getting fired up on the couch. And I'm like, this McGuire kid is All-American short stick D-Mitty potential. Incredible play. Nobody even jumping on the bench. The end of the bench was quiet. The front of the bench was quiet. And that, to me, was my biggest takeaway of this game. Red flags for Duke's locker room.
Interesting. Okay, that's why you show up for the Tailgate Podcast. That's what Nicky O is going to give you every other Sunday. My takeaway from this game was Duke's freshman face-off specialists, or just specialists, not face-off specific, although he is one of the two. And the reason is because, and I think the reason it's significant is because, number one, Duke is always going to be able to recruit really well. So the fact that they have, you know, freshmen contributing, not shocking. That being said, A, they brought in more than the typical number of grad transfers, particularly at the offensive end. And those guys have contributed, specifically Eric Molliver and Luke Graham, who were their leading scorers again against Jacksonville. But they had a returning starting goalie who was a freshman last year in Patrick Jamison. So when it was tied 5-5, 22 minutes in, about 8 minutes to go in the first quarter, Jacksonville had won 8 of 12 faceoffs, and Duke had made just one save. This is a Dolphin team who graduated Nathan Kapp, who was top 10 all-time in career faceoff wins. So it's not as if they came in with a significant advantage facing off. And so at that time, Ben McCarthy, the freshman, had only taken three. He won two of them. He finished 12 of 17, which means that after the first 12 faceoffs, he took 14 and he won 10 of 14. So that was, to me, a significant factor in the outcome. And then Buck Cunningham, a freshman from Colorado, came on in second half relief, and he made four saves while allowing three goals. And I think the combination of those two factors allowed Duke, who had a two-goal lead at halftime, to just settle in a little bit, right? And, you know, they had taken care of business against Bellarmine. They were on the road in Jacksonville against a team who had been humbled in the JMA Wireless Dome the weekend prior and needed that opportunity to settle. And so I think that those two freshmen, that was a really significant factor. And to the point of, you know, that has been brought up multiple times on this podcast already, the team who wins the national championship is going to be the team that's best at getting better over the course of the season. I mean, obviously you have to be talented, but you have to get a lot better than you are right now, unless maybe Notre Dame is good enough today to be the best team on Memorial Day. We haven't seen them play. But if you're going to be relying on a fair number of freshmen and then also a fair number of newcomers, the freshmen are going to get better because they're going to learn what college lacrosse is all about, and the newcomers hopefully will get better because they're going to develop chemistry. And so for me, those are the factors that kind of still remain and that I want to see how they shake out for the Blue Devils going forward.
Are there any other games that kind of either were head scratchers or ones that you took something away from?
We got a shout out Stony Brook for beating Rutgers 9-8. Congratulations to the Seawolves. They scrimmaged Harvard last week and came away with a W in that scrimmage as well. Or if not a W, then they were, I guess, either even or slightly better when the starters were in. So keep an eye on Anthony Gilardi's team in the America East. And then, yeah, I mean, there are a couple others. Army jumped out to a big lead on UMass. And then after UMass cut into that lead, they managed to separate. VMI jumped out to a 7-0 lead on High Point was able to dig themselves all the way out of that hole in order to win in overtime. I think those are it.
Yeah, that was the biggest head scratcher for me was High Point VMI. You know, High Point had a pretty good showing against Navy. You know, as far as where to rank, And maybe this was just from my time, but VMI was never a team that you had to worry about too much. And, you know, even heading into this season, I'd say, oh, High Point would be a 5.5 point favorite. So good showing from the VMI boys. You put in a little worry meter on High Point's ability to maintain their giant worrier in the same team that we were talking about, Jacksonville.
Yeah, I think that it's a down to the studs rebuild there in the wooden furniture capital of, I think, the world. Might be just the United States, but they make a lot of wooden furniture in High Point, North Carolina.
I was going to call that the battle of contrasting campuses, VMIs versus High Points, but I'm not going to go into it too much because I've already slighted VMI too much. So,
all right, Nick, that'll do it for this edition of the Tailgate Podcast. Thank you to Jake Hervada for providing just pearls of wisdom and insight.
Yeah, not really a thank you. How about let's get better next time, buddy.
You know what's not a great method for attracting guests is to totally trash them after they come on. So I'm going to put you in the, what do you call it? I don't know.
Timeout?
No, the just like the gym, I guess. You got to get better at complimenting the guests after they come on.
Don't have bad showings. I mean, seems like a pretty easy way for me to not be a dick after an interview is to have a good interview.
Nick, you got a.
All that saying, I love Jake. So
you've got a. Is it flag or touch football game to get to?
Touch.
All right. Well, then go get him. We can't wait to hear about how you injured yourself this time next week.
Yeah, hammy is minus -110. I think Achilles is plus +150. Full knee rebuild plus +225. Lower back pain minus a trillion. So
there you go. Thank you for listening to the Tailgate Podcast. If you like what you heard, leave a rating and a review. Tell a friend. And by this time next week, the Fighting Irish may have a loss to Cleveland State.
They may. I mean, technically anything's possible. I may have hair by this time next week. So let's keep eyes on both of those.
Love you more, Nick.
Love you, Terry.